Katie, we're on the air. And my co-host tonight is Katie O'Brien. And again, our special guest tonight is Charles Key. And he's a representative with the Oklahoma House, correct?
And, that's correct.
Okay. And he's also been involved with the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing. And if you'd like to finish telling us a little bit more about what you have been doing with the Oklahoma City bombing and with the legislation you've been involved with, and a little bit more about you.
Well, I served in the Oklahoma House of Representatives from 1986 until 1998, and it was in that the latter several years in that time frame in which the Oklahoma City bombing happened, and I got involved in the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing case. I'm not still investigating the Oklahoma City bombing, but it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, for lack of a proper way to describe an experience like that. I knew people that died in the bombing and people that had loved ones that died in the bombing. My first secretary, who was not just my secretary, was actually a friend and a fellow church parishioner, died in the bombing in the building. She had worked for me and then gone to work for the federal government and then died in that tragedy. And I still go to church with her whole family, her parents, her brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, and even her son, who's left fatherless and motherless now. So everybody in Oklahoma City experienced the bombing. It was a tragedy. And then on top of that, it was a major cover-up. But I'm not still investigating the bombing. I still hear about it. I hear about the ongoing investigation that others are carrying out, and I'm familiar with what's going on in recent years and up to the present time. But my interest is in the Oklahoma legislature because I was reelected again in 2006. I didn't really plan on running for office again. I hadn't totally decided not to run, but circumstances kind of developed in 2006, and I was asked to run again for my old House seat, and I did, and won re-election, and so here I am, back in the Oklahoma legislature again. Recently, I had filed and passed a bill out of the House of Representatives called the 10th Amendment Resolution, and that's gotten a lot of real interest all over the country from all types of folks that are interested in our country remaining a constitutional republic and us going back to that constitution that formed this country and defines what it, you know, how it's to function and defines what roles that the federal government and all the other levels of government are to play and what rights they do not have and what boundaries they have to stay within. And so, to my surprise, very pleasant surprise, it's been very well received, and it's really kind of a firestorm across the country right now of interest about this 10th Amendment resolution.
Do you want to explain what the 10th Amendment is for our listeners?
The 10th Amendment to the Constitution says that all the powers that haven't been specifically given to the federal government are left to the states and the people, period. So to put it another way, it says that the federal government can only do what it's been given the right to do, specifically written in the Constitution. And the answer to the question, well, what are they doing or what have they done, is that they have gone far, far, far beyond, in many ways, beyond what the Constitution has said that they could do and what was their function, their role. The federal government was actually a creation of us, we the people. The federal government didn't create the Constitution or decide, you know, what rights the people had or the states had. It was actually just the opposite. The people created the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and that Constitution and Declaration of Independence specifically says, you know, the things that we believe in, that our rights come from a creator and that is the beginning point. And after that, the people said that they would create a government, and they specifically said, here's what this government will do for us, and here's what it can do, but it can't do anything else beyond that. And so the federal government's gone way beyond that for decades now and violated it so terribly that we're on the verge of actually losing our Constitution and our country.
And so why did you decide to address it from the Oklahoma legislature?
Well, when I was in the legislature before, it was actually a Colorado state senator that came up with the idea, and he actually had passed it in the Colorado legislature, and also other legislators filed the 10th Amendment resolution in their states and passed it in their states. And when I was in the legislature before, I passed it in Oklahoma in the Oklahoma House of Representatives. And so when I came back and was reelected again, it was one of the things that I was at the top of my list that I wanted to file and pass. And the political climate and lay of the land had changed significantly in Oklahoma. When I was in the legislature in the 80s and 90s, I'm a Republican, and the Republicans were in the minority in both the House and the Senate. Since that time, the Republicans have taken over the House. And in the Senate, it's in a 50-50 split, 24 Democrats, 24 Republicans. So it was much more favorable to a Republican proposing legislation like this and having the opportunity to pass it. And it passed overwhelmingly in the House, 92-3. It was when it got to the Senate that they couldn't get a hearing because they are split down the middle and are kind of in a deadlock in the Senate.
So you said you started in the 80s as far as the legislature. Where along the lines did you get involved in with the Oklahoma City bombing? May I ask that? I mean, I know it's kind of skipping the subject just a little bit, because I know we want to get back to this 10th Amendment thing, too, because I really do feel that that's very important for right now. But I just wanted to kind of get that out there before we approach this other subject a little bit.
Well, of course, I was here. I live right here in Oklahoma City, and I was in my business office when the bomb went off. You know, everybody remembers where they were, especially if you live in Oklahoma City, when the bombing happened. And I remember exactly what happened, just like it was yesterday. And I was sitting in my insurance office with my partner and my secretary. The office that we were sitting in was right in the center of this two-story building. And so we heard this double kind of a boom, kind of a rumbling. And the sensation was as if workers were on top of the building moving or replacing a big heat and air unit. And as a matter of fact, we made the comment to ourselves, are they changing out the air conditioning systems or something? And, you know, it was just a few minutes. It was probably 3 minutes after that the phone rang, and it was my secretary down at the state capitol called and said, did you see what happened downtown? And I said, no. She said, well, there's been some kind of an explosion. And immediately everybody thought it was a gas line or something like that. She said, you ought to go outside and look at it and look towards downtown. Then you need to get down here right away. Well, we went outside and looked straight east, which we were almost due east from the Capitol, and you could see all the smoke coming up. And so I immediately got in my car and headed to the Capitol and then listened to the news coverage. And then as I approached the Capitol, could see the smoke and came into the building. I remember walking into the building with a lobbyist, actually the representative of a firefighters association. He and I said several things to each other that something, you know, of course, bad had happened. And he said, well, I think it was a gas line. And I said, I don't know, Pete. I'm afraid it might be worse than that. And he said, I know, I think it's a gas line. And so we went in, and of course the rest is kind of history. Things developed real quickly. One of the state reps was actually coming to the Capitol, and he was right by the, very close to the building, not across the street from it, but within a, just a little bit less than a block away. And it, when the explosion occurred, I should say the explosions occurred, it caused his car to lose control, and he ran into another car or something and parked a car, and then got at it, knocked out his windshield. He got out and started helping people. And when he got to the Capitol, he was kind of in a frantic state of mind. He was shocked. He was almost in shock. He said it was like a war zone, and he was describing what he saw, and he was just really very emotional and incredulous about the whole thing. So we shut down immediately, and the whole Capitol was shut down, and everybody went home, and then we all saw the case unfold, and you saw the immediate reporting and the immediate comments from public officials about the bomb, about who was responsible, about messages of prior warning, and multiple bombs being found, and things like that. And then the story started changing within about 48 hours, and 3 days and 4 days down the road. And the more time went by, the more they just tried to sweep under the rug all these other things. Long story short, I eventually talked to other experts and heard what they had to say, and came to a point where I felt compelled to do something about it besides just watch it happen and say, well, this is somebody else's problem, I can't do anything about it. And got very involved and very public, and knew that once I got started, it was not something you just got involved, got into it on a part-time basis or just for a little while. You're 100% committed or not. And so I was 100% committed to go down the path, and it was very dynamic and very very eye-opening about what the way things really work in our government, getting yet even another deeper look at cover-ups when the government wants to cover something up, how they do it, and how many people will go along with it, not because they're a part of it, maybe not even because they're threatened, but because they feel maybe threatened that they could lose their jobs or their retirement, or they don't want bad publicity because they don't want to be called names like they called me and others. And so it's a real interesting thing to see how these things work and how a lot of society will go along with it, and how a lot of people go into denial and they don't want to look at these facts that show that their government is lying for some reason and covering things up and not pursuing all of the perpetrators. A lot of people don't want to face that.
Was it ever revealed what happened to the bombs that they supposedly defused?
No, because they get control of those things. They do something with them, and then any documentation or paperwork or what have you is under their control, so there's no way for it to be revealed. I mean, it's possible it could be revealed, but it would take others in the government to force it to be revealed. And, as I just kind of generally overviewed, most people won't do that because they don't want to put their political careers on the line or their income, retirement on the line, particularly
so,
at risk.
So when you were doing this investigation, it was while you were still representing the people of Oklahoma then?
Yes.
Okay. And were you involved very long before?
Well, the bombing happened in 95,
mm-hmm.
and I was defeated in 1998.
Okay.
So in 96, to give you an idea of what people in my district and people in Oklahoma thought about this state representative coming out publicly and saying there's a cover-up, the federal government is not going after all the perpetrators, there's evidence of prior knowledge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In 96, they couldn't find somebody to run against me. Now, I did have an opponent. It was a college student. And I won that race 75 to 25%. That was 1 year after the bombing and after the first year of me coming out in this controversial and sensational way, and you know, making these claims. And then, you know, you'd think that if it was so controversial, you'd have people lined up to run against me, and that people would vote me out of office. But it wasn't like that at all. Most people thought it was reasonable to ask these questions because I did it and we did it in a very reasonable way. You know, we were just simply asking reasonable questions and wanting and hoping, expecting to get reasonable answers. Of course, the answers weren't forthcoming. So what happened after 96 is there was a systematic attack that began on me that went for about a year, year and a half before the next election, which was 98. And there was an organized effort to come after me and to kind of demonize me in the press and the main newspaper in Oklahoma and Oklahoma City, you know, just kind of beat the drums and pounded the drums that it's time for me to get, you know, to stop this investigation and to drop it. One of their editorials was, "Drop it, Mr. Key." And you know, they were able to get me into a runoff, and then they beat me in the runoff.
So do you know who your opponents were? Were they on the, you know, in the, are they coming in from out of Oklahoma, or were they coming from more or less the federal government? Do you have any idea?
Well, it was just people that, people that, I'd refer to them as, well, like I did in the opening statements about this, you know, you've got a combination of people. You've got people that intentionally want to shut someone up because they want to go along, or they're part of the cover-up, and they know they are. And whether they rationalize and think it's the best or it's the right way for government to function and that most citizens don't need to know or have a right to know, doesn't really matter. They are intentionally involved in a cover-up. But there's a lot of people that go along with it because they buy into other beliefs that this couldn't, you know, this cover-up couldn't possibly happen, and anyone that would claim that it was, you know, they don't look at the facts, but they buy into the accusations of people being conspiracy theorists, quote, and other names that people are called by. And a lot of these people, some in the media and others in other places in government, they go along with it because they look at it in more of a simplistic way, like sheep being led along. You follow what I'm saying?
Right.
So you've got your willing dupes, and you've got your people intentionally, you know, beating the drums. And so that comes from people in the federal government, people at the state government, and you've even got citizens that go along with it, that buy into it, because they don't want to. They'd rather believe the lie than look at the truth.
So with this background on asking the questions, and then, so then, are you saying that you got defeated for, what, 2 years? Is that what happened there?
No, I was actually out of office for 8 years.
Oh, for 8 years. Okay.
Yeah, from 98 until 2006.
Oh, so then you just recently got back in then.
Yeah.
Okay. And had the voters changed a whole lot of way that their perceptions on over that period of time on looking at this sort of thing, or did you run on something totally different?
Well, I certainly didn't run on the bombing, but my opponents in 2006, just 2 years ago, there were two other persons that were running besides myself, and they both just beat the fire out of me about the bombing.
Well, I would have figured that would have been what they would have gone.
And one of them was a millionaire, and he spent about $170,000 to my $20, and ran radio ads, tons of direct mail, and just beat me, you know, to death practically. I thought I knew what they would do, and that all they could do was what had happened to me before, but it actually went to a level I never dreamed that it would go to. But we still won. It was very close, but we won. And what I found as I went door to door in that campaign 2 years ago is that people's opinions have changed. And not that they were dramatically different back in the few years after the bombing during that time, because the fact is there were polls that were done by USA Today, and then I think the other one was done by the Tulsa World newspaper, asking people some questions about whether they thought there were other people involved in the bombing, and I forget the other one or two questions. And then one of the local radio radio station did a number of surveys, and the surveys almost always came out very decisively on the side of the people feeling very strongly that there was a cover-up in the Oklahoma City bombing. So people have always felt that way and believe that. How they were able to come and defeat someone like me is they put on a very intense, it's kind of like what they did to Ron Paul. You know, you either ignore your opponent, and when that doesn't work, then you attack him as being, you know, crazy or way off the, out of the norm, and you know, have very strange or odd ideas and beliefs. You make people feel uncomfortable voting for him or her. And that's the psychology that goes on is what most people don't really pick up on. And even if they kind of know something like that's going on, they're manipulated by it because they're not sophisticated enough politically and to know how the how media works and how it's used to try to accomplish things. And so that's real simply what they did to me in 98. But a lot of things have happened in 8 years, and what I found as I went door to door in 2006 is that there was a big change in a large percentage of the population's attitudes and their specific knowledge about things that were going on in the country and in our state, like the illegal alien problem and things like that. So there's a much deeper, more cynical much greater distrust about government than there was when I was in office before.
So what was the platform?
Which kind of gave me a cushion, you know, when they attacked me. It put them at question because they didn't, you know, on one hand, people didn't believe my attackers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that I said in this 2006 election was that I'm not running on the bombing. Why? It's not right. I didn't say it exactly like this, but it was very plain that it's not right that these people try to use the bombing to get themselves elected.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they were doing, is trying to use the bombing at my expense to get themselves elected. Because I had the most name ID and people knew who I was, and all the polls showed that I was going to win real easily. So their only choice was to, you know, attack and mudsling at me.
So what platform did you have?
Well, my platform's always been one that's just been limited government, constitutional government, no tax increases, you know, freedom, free markets, freedom of expression, let people live their lives and not be hindered and controlled by government action, keep it to a minimum. You know, just basically the freedom message.
Uh-huh. And do you feel that those platforms that have been used, I mean, that has been used on the national level as well, do you feel like they've followed that?
Well, you know, in my district's pretty conservative. It's a real conservative district, mostly mm-hmm. Republican. Even the Democrats are pretty conservative. It's a Christian area. It's an area where it's fundamentalist Christian, but probably even more a real strong part of that population is even kind of libertarian in their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a natural fit for people in my district.
Well, the only reason I was asking that is because I've heard that on a national level, and yet when you saw what was taking place in reality, it seemed like it was quite the opposite, and like they had gotten away from the very thing that you're talking about you were running on.
Well, yeah, and I know what you're saying. I think probably my answer to that is, and I don't have the perfect answer for it, but I think, you know, there's a big difference between a state house or state senate race and a statewide office or a national office, like running for president. So it's more difficult when you're running for president to really reach people at a level where they can really see you and get to know you and get to hear your message. And it's hard to get to a lot of people. You know, if you had a lot of money, then you could do something, but it's very difficult. And I think what the national media has done in this presidential election this last 12 months or so is, you know, they've shown a lot of favoritism to the candidates that they favored, and then they did not give any either preferential treatment or any treatment at all to a lot of other candidates. So those candidates didn't have the benefit of name recognition, name ID being developed because they're in the news. But you have people like Giuliani and McCain and Hillary, and, you know, just the, we all know who's the favorites, and they get a lot more publicity, and that's been shown to be exactly the case when they measure the amount of time that they actually give free, you know, quote, free publicity.
So who was the
candidates running for office?
So who was the Colorado person that had come up with this idea to for the state sovereignty? Is it state sovereignty? How do you describe your bill?
It's called the 10th Amendment Resolution.
Okay.
And, you know, state sovereignty is built into the Constitution. And so we just call it the 10th Amendment Resolution because it's the 10th Amendment that states, you know, what we talked about earlier, that the federal government only has certain rights. When we created this country and it was founded and they wrote the Constitution, they didn't say, okay, we're creating a federal government. They get to make all the laws and decide everything that people can and can't do. That's not what happened, and it doesn't say that. It says, here are the only things that the federal government can do, period. And then it says, in the 10th Amendment, it turns around and says, it's kind of like saying parenthetically, now let's make this clear. Only the things we've said that the federal government can do, they can do. But anything else, they cannot do that. And that's left to the states and the people for everything else. And, you know, we don't think like that anymore. People, kids coming out of school, very few of them get that. They either don't get it, get taught that, or it's not really a clear teaching on this constitutional form of government. And most people have this impression, well, the government, the legislatures and Congress, the president, they make laws, they tell people what they can do and can't do. And if we don't like it, we have to tell our representatives and try to get them to not pass laws or get them to pass laws that we want. And that's the way it works. Well, it's not supposed to work that way. Every elected official is supposed to just follow what the Constitution says and only it, and protect it and not violate it. But the violation of the Constitution has become not just common, but almost the norm.
When do you think that actually happened in our history? When the federal government... Go ahead.
Well, it started in the very beginning. I mean, it's human nature to get into powerful positions and start wanting to, whether it's do things for your friends, do things for monetary gain or political gain, or it's a lot of it's just that, you know, now that I'm in charge, we'll do things, I'll do what I want to do. In a Supreme Court case called Marbury versus Madison, one of the most popular cases in American history, I think it was in 1813 or 1817, something like that, one of the questions the court looked at was who's going to decide what the Constitution says and what it means? And the Supreme Court said, well, I guess somebody has to decide, so we'll pick ourselves to be the ones to decide what it means. Well, that's a problem in and of itself. What if they violate the Constitution? Does the Supreme Court have the right to interpret beyond what the Constitution says and means? And is the Constitution so complicated that the average person can't understand it? Do we need somebody to, quote, interpret it? I don't think so. And these kind of questions have been faced by Americans throughout our history. We just don't We just haven't seen it happen, or we haven't studied it. The Constitution is real simple. You know, it's not rocket science. Any of us can understand it. The best thing people could do is get a Constitution, read it. If you need to, read it again and read it often and become familiar with it, especially the first 10 amendments. And it's pretty clear. And then judge your government based on what you learn there.
Do you think you're going to have an easy time being able to put it through the Senate?
Well, the Republicans are expected to win here in Oklahoma the Senate, the majority in the Senate, this election cycle. So I'm pretty optimistic that it'll get a hearing and it will pass. But, you know, never underestimate the attempts of those that don't like to be bound, like Thomas Jefferson said, that don't like to be bound by the chains of the Constitution. You know, there's a famous quote where he said, "Bind them down with the chains of the Constitution," meaning the words of the Constitution. You know, the requirements of the Constitution, and that's what the Constitution does. It binds the government down and says, this is all that you can do, and you can do no more. And there are people, when they get in government, they don't like that. They like to do what they want to do.
Are there other states that are in the same process?
Yeah, there are many states. It's kind of interesting how, and I'm really, again, pleased about how the interest of in this bill has really taken off. I've been contacted by a lot of sitting state representatives and senators from other states who are very interested, and some of them saying they are going to introduce this legislation in their next legislative session, which will start, you know, after the first of the year. So we're real hopeful that this will be something we see in many states right after the first of the year.
So you'll be the groundbreakers, though, if this goes through, then?
Well, it looks like it, you know. So, mm-hmm. But there's other people there, and myself, we're coming up with other ideas. Well, what else can we do to correct this problem of the federal government going way out of its bounds of the Constitution and taking money and property that it doesn't have from us, and then holding it over our heads in the form of subsidies or mandates, and saying, well, you're going to have to do this or that, such as now have a national ID card, they're calling it the real ID, or we won't give you this money, or you won't be able to fly on airplanes, or this or that. There's a real problem. You know, they're using their power, not their legal right, because they do not have the legal right. They're trying to use their power to force us to do things that they have no right to do and that we don't have any obligation to do, other than they're trying to use the power of force. And it's moving quickly from just holding money back from the states that they didn't have the right to take in the first place, to the point where now it's going to be threats of actual force. And we need to turn this around before it gets worse.
How do we do that?
Well, we do it with legislation like this, but we have to be able to go beyond this, because we're going to have to meet them with equal resolve, we'll put it that way. And some other hopeful signs is on this Real ID legislation that the Congress passed just a few years ago. You may have know this or may have covered it on some of your programs. The Real ID Act has now been rejected either outright or to some degree by about 40 states now. Oklahoma was one of the first ones to take the charge, I'm happy to say that we will not participate in the Real ID Act. We passed Senate Bills 464 in 2007. I was the House author of that bill, and Oklahoma went on record, not just as a statement in a joint resolution, but with some actual substantive law that said we will not participate in it, and no state agency in Oklahoma will participate in the Real ID Act. Well, we followed that up this year with some legislation that we were not successful in passing, but we filed to further try to protect the privacy rights and the constitutional rights of citizens in Oklahoma by making sure that their identity and their personal information that's gathered whenever you get a driver's license, for example, or you have other information that's given to government, and then a lot of these governments, state governments, are starting to pass that information on to organizations that are kind of quasi-government agencies that are then sharing that with Canada, Mexico, and the plan is that they'll start sharing it with countries all over the world. It'll be an international sharing of information and therefore an international identification. That's a real big problem for many reasons, but we and other states have passed or at least filed legislation. In some states, I heard last night that West Virginia passed a law that said they cannot use digital photographs when they take their photograph for a driver's license. Or actually, they can't use the digitals, and then the ones they've used in the recent past, they have to destroy them right after they have to destroy those digital photographs. So that and things like that is where the next wave of legislation to try to protect citizens and also try to turn back what's happened with the Real ID Act.
Now, in your House and Senate, is there a lot of support for these areas where the government is encroaching, or do you find yourself fighting more, you know, back and forth here?
Well, there is a lot of support because, like, the 10th Amendment resolution passed in the House 92-3.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Now, again, we had this problem over in the Senate where it didn't get a hearing, but then we had a number of Real ID bills, legislation, without going into a long explanation of why we had quite a number of them. We were trying to attack different aspects of Real ID on a subject-by-subject basis for one reason. But we passed laws, we passed some Real ID, anti-Real ID legislation out of the House and the Senate. They were not real close, but they weren't big margins like the 10th Amendment Act. But we had a lot of opposition, and it was mainly from our Department of Public Safety, you know, which is the Highway Patrol, the law enforcement agency of the state. And we had a number of very strong closed-door meetings with the head of the Department of Public Safety and one of his top lieutenants about their efforts to try to stop this. And so it's an ongoing battle that we're having here in Oklahoma. And I'm not sure what's going to happen next year, but there's going to be some more fireworks probably take place in Oklahoma about this issue.
So where was the biggest resistance on the people's part with this ID, real ID?
There really wasn't. I mean, the people were overwhelmingly in support of repealing or not participating in the Real ID and protecting, being protected from, you know, identity theft, from privacy and constitutional violations and infringements, and then the cost of it is tremendous also. So as a matter of fact, I did a survey in my district, and the number came out to be something like, what was it? It was about 90% opposed to Real ID. Maybe it was 86 or... I think maybe it was 86% opposed to Real ID. I wanted to know what my constituents thought, so I sent out a survey. That's what I got, 86% against it.
So
I suspect all over the state of Oklahoma you'll find real similar numbers. There might be some exceptions to that here or there, but for the most part, I would think most people in our state, and probably I think maybe in most of the states, probably a state like yours, people would not be for the Real ID Act, and they'd like their legislators to stand up and protect them.
I have not addressed this subject, and it is one I've intended to get in more in depth in. But as far as you might get into a little bit on what Real ID might mean with the animals. Are you up on that part of that issue?
Well, I'm familiar with it, but I haven't really researched it because we actually had another legislator that was interested in that and was going to pursue it, but nothing happened in the Oklahoma legislature. But I mean, I think I understand it to be essentially the same way. They're wanting to tag and for the purposes of, I think, ultimately controlling farm animals and who knows what all, you know, maybe all animals. And they'll probably put tags in our ears after a while, too. They'd like to tag all of us.
Well, if they put it in the science fiction parts, that's for sure. So we never know where that'll, you know, end up.
I mean, you know, you got to, just to throw a little humor in here, you got to wonder what some of these people are thinking, you know. One thing I always thought was real, would be real helpful is if legislators could only serve one term. And so when people talk about term limits, you know, the ultimate reason for term limits is because you want those citizen legislators to think every time they push a button for or against a bill, voting on it, that they think in terms of, wait a minute, what's this going to mean to me if I have to go back out in the real world, you know, tomorrow? Do I really want this law? And that's what happens. That's a big part of what happens. You get elected, you get up there, and you kind of, you know, this invisible shield is kind of put between you and the real world out there. And if you were voting from the standpoint of having to leave that position and go back in the real world, try to make a living and live like everybody else, you'd probably vote no a whole lot more. And so you get these bureaucrats and others in the bureaucracies at the federal and state level, they come up with these ideas, or somebody's coming up with them, and you wonder, you know, gosh, what were they thinking? What are they really trying to accomplish here? Really know what's best for us better than we do.
Were there any other aspects that of federal encroachment that, you know, had prompted you to bring out this legislation?
Well, the 10th Amendment resolution, you mean?
Right.
Well, you know, another area, I think, of recent years is education. Of course, that's been going on for several decades also. There's nothing, you know, and I would encourage people, look at the Constitution, the United States Constitution. See if you can find anywhere in there where it says that the federal government can do anything within the area of education. They can't, because it's not in there. And it's not, see, they don't have the right to do things that aren't addressed in the Constitution. They can only do the things that are specifically stated that they can do. And they have no right, so therefore it's illegal for them to have a Department of Education to pass laws that say, you know, well, the states are going to have to do X, Y, and Z regarding education. You know, and I'm thinking recently about the No Child Left Behind law that was passed at the federal level. That has not been beneficial to the people in this country at any state, any local level. And it's the people at the local level, the parents first, and the teachers and the administrators and what have you, people in that state that need to make those decisions about what's best for those children. But it's another area in which not only is the federal government spending our money, taxing us, but then they're telling us what we can and can't do, and then they're holding those funds and holding us hostage if we don't do what they say.
Katie, did you have anything else you wanted to ask? Are you there?
Not at this time.
Okay. So, what do you think, what do you attribute your most, I don't want to say, that you've accomplished the most? Is it this this 10th Amendment thing that you're, I keep saying legislation and you keep calling it something else, so I kind of get a little tripped up on how to approach, how to state what this is. So,
well, it is legislation. Anything that's a resolution or a bill, those are all called legislation, so... I'm pretty pleased with that because it's, you know, it kind of speaks for itself. It really kind of simplifies, and it, at the same time, it educates and informs people.
Because when I first was acquainted with you, you were on a program, Rule of Law, I believe, that and you were also with was it Chris Emery on that program, and that Deborah Stevens and Randy Kelton had been getting into the Oklahoma bombing issue, but then again. I've caught you several times on other programs where you were, people were commending you on your resolution, and that they were hoping more states would get on board with this type of resolution. And so, do you foresee anything else in the works that you're working on, or?
Well, myself and a state senator here in Oklahoma named Randy Brogdon, he's from a small city around the Tulsa, Oklahoma area, we're the leaders on the Real ID Act in trying to either repeal or protect our citizens of Oklahoma from that. That's a big piece of legislation that we'll continue to address. Another big piece of legislation, or a big issue, I should say, out there that was a big deal for the last couple of years, and it looks like we may have stopped it, at least temporarily, was the NAFTA superhighway. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's another big one that's going through, trying to get through your state, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that thing would be coming right up the middle of our state, and it was kind of like it would appear that it was a must-have for those that wanted it. You know, they had to have Oklahoma to go along with it. Of course, they could go around us probably, but that would be a real problem for them. But the people of Oklahoma and Texas band together and organized in such a way that they were actually able to stop it, and it's being repealed or at least stopped in the state of Texas. And in Oklahoma, there were a few pieces of legislation these last 2 years, two or three, I should say, that were brought forward in which they were trying to lay the groundwork to then be able to bring it up through Oklahoma. And we were able to stop that. There was a citizens group that formed called OK Safe, and you could look them up on the Internet, OK, I think it might be Dash Safe, S-A-F-E. And they might even be willing to come on your program sometime and talk about the things that they're involved in.
Okay.
But
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Safe is their name that I'll look up. Okay. Great. Because I have had Terry Hall and some others on speaking about the Trans-Texas Corridor. So.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, we were able to stop it pretty much dead in its tracks in Oklahoma.
And what is, for the listening audience, what is the purpose of this NAFTA superhighway?
Well, the purpose is to be able to bring goods from primarily China, but other parts of the world, up through the Port Cardenas area in Mexico, which is on the Pacific coast, and bring it all the way up and through this main artery that would come up through the middle of Texas and Oklahoma and middle of the country up to Kansas City. And then it would have arteries that would go out from that point to distribute all over North America cheap goods, and do it at a much cheaper cost, because it would have a certain amount, if not complete, immunity from the costs that are involved now when you bring goods into our country. And that's ultimately what it was all about, is money. But to accomplish the most efficient and reduce the cost to the extent that they, you know, wanted to, they would have to not only have this huge system and these huge roads, but they would have to have the control over them so that to the level that they bypassed issues of sovereignty and eminent domain. And so that was the ultimate grand plan, is that these highways would be pretty much sovereign territory of some entity other than the United States. And, you know, the Kansas City Smart Port was already given, or the country of Mexico was given some land up there in the Kansas City Smart Port operation.
We had something kind of interesting, and I, you know, took note of it. I don't know that much others thought of it, but we had a Mexican consulate, I believe, come through our area, and from what I understand, had visited every county in the state, and then they went through Utah and Idaho and Omaha. And I thought that was kind of interesting, why they would be taking such an interest coming and visiting. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I just thought it was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Charles, I guess it's getting to that point where I need to go ahead and change over to some people that you may be familiar with, because we're going to have Andrew Griffin and Chris Emery and Holland Vanden Neuhoff. Is that how? Vanden? I won't even try to pronounce his last name.
I just call him Holland.
Holland, there we go. Anyways, I'm going to have them up next for the next hour, and I really do appreciate you coming on our program and being patient with our flying by the seat of our pants sometimes when we're trying to do some different technologies here, and as we switch things back and forth. So, but I would, you know, it'd be great if we could have you back on sometime, and particularly if we could, you know, announce that your legislation is successful.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and I'd be glad to come back anytime. I know those guys that are coming on, and I know Chris especially in Holland. Well, and I know Chris very well, and he's a good friend of mine, and they're great guys. They're doing fantastic work.
Okay, well,
tell them I said hi.
Okay, and Katie, I want to say thank you, and we'll be back here again soon. So I'll go ahead and say goodnight, Charles and Charles Key and Katie O'Brien.
Good night.
All right, thank you,
Charles.
Uh-huh. Good night.
Thank you.